You are listening to the Colorado Bowhunters Association podcast. I am your host, Jake Kunkin.
Welcome back to another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bow Hunting. I have with me a important member of the CBA, as well as a podcast regular, Wes Mendez. Wes, how you been, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Jake?
I'm doing well. It's Valentine's Day. Just dropped my girlfriend off at the airport, so my Valentine's duties are over, and it's just me and the dog for a few weeks, which is nice. Nice. She's not my girlfriend. She's my fiance. I just got engaged a couple weeks ago.
Well, congratulations. Thanks, man. That's really cool.
Yeah. So I don't mind her going off into another country without me by her side. I already locked it down, so we're good there. How have you been? How are things in your world?
I've been good. I mean, like I said, you know, it's been busy with work, and then, you know, with everything kicking off at the legislature and ballot initiatives, it seems like we flipped the script on 2023 and immediately walked into 2024, and everything was on fire.
You're right. It felt like 2023 was so many positive wins, momentum, partnerships with CPW, the commission. And it's not that that stuff didn't happen or went away, but it's just like a whole nother tidal wave came right behind it. And this is the time of year across the country that the policies are starting to come out and get talked about. And so, you know, I'm sure howl.org is busy as hell, but it's interesting to hear, all right, a lot of people are focusing on Colorado. There's stuff happening in Nebraska right now. There's stuff happening all over the place. And it's just like, it's a lot to pay attention to as a community.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I'm curious about your views about both like Colorado as a state and like nationally in terms of like just the landscape right now and what's going on.
No, that's a good question. So there's a couple things we knew it going into 2024, right? You're walking into an election year. So immediately there's going to be a lot of legislation that's going to come with more of a statement behind it. Something that grabs headlines. People are looking for reelection. And then, you know, that's going to be reciprocated at the national level, except on steroids.
Yeah.
I would say the biggest thing we've seen and that we've continued to see over the last, like, I don't want to say 4 years, even going on beyond that, is really for the first time, we're really starting to see this like weird intertwining between federal and state issues. And what I really mean by that is there will be some degree of involvement, largely due to the fact that people maybe who be in power in the administration that came from DC have connections into DC. And we've seen with the new administration at the DC level, some of the cabinet members may have a different viewpoint on kind of redefining conservation or getting more involved in kind of rewilding initiatives. So
in a bad way or a good way?
I would say more from a political optics perspective.
Gotcha.
So like, for example, like the Department of Interior, there's been kind of initiatives around reintroduction of bison and looking how to do that. And like I said, from a stumping to a crowd and talking about the issue, you get people nodding. It sounds really sexy and attractive. But when you get to the grassroots of like, well, how do you do that? And how do you pay for it? And, you know, bison don't just stand one place. You'd have to fence them in. And if you're, where are you going to find the land? And if you have contamination with cattle, like bison carry brucellosis. So if you're not going to vaccinate, like you start walking through that, you know, it's millions of dollars. And you get this, what's really states' rights versus federal rights? You know, where would you put it? It starts to get really convoluted and complex, and you got state land, you have BLM, U.S. Forest Service land, maybe national park land. Like it just turns into a very tenable,
messy
situation
group of stakeholders.
It's like, so who's in charge of it? and that's what you get.
On top of that, I'm just looking up now. It looks like Laura Daniel Davis is the current Secretary of the Interior. She just started October 31st, so like she's 3 months into this job. During an election year.
Yeah. And then the big one who's up at Department of Interior is Deb Holland.
Okay.
So she came out of New Mexico and her, you know, she's a politician. She kind of came up through that way. She's off. She obviously has a very different slant in terms of, you know, what she would like to see on the landscape, and views of conservation. And that trickles down, right? Because you have U.S. Forest Service that's under that umbrella, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management. There's been more rulings from BLM coming out about allowing kind of access opportunities and potentially restricting that. You know, so it's a weird situation in that while we've not historically been that involved at the federal level, now we're starting to get involved at the federal level, and conservation groups are going to have to get and play at that level. And we started playing at this level last year. We made a trip to DC kind of for the first time, just start to have those conversations, to say, hey, you know, you're only getting one perspective from maybe an activist group that's advocating for these policies. You know, it's not grounded in well, what does it look like from an economic perspective and industry perspective? Like there's a lot behind this that's just not vetted. And before you go pull the trigger on something, you need to have really honest conversations, because it could have a lot of damaging consequences across the landscape for multiple businesses, for people, for, you know, industries. It's just not as simplistic at that level.
Do you think that's a part of this strategy, is to gum up the works, to make it difficult to see where progress can be made or change can be affected because it's so like cross-threaded? Or is it just a happenstance of the complexities of all the user groups?
I think it's a happenstance. So like, I think their viewpoint, some of the activists' viewpoint would be, hey, we would like to have I'll just throw it out. And it's, I wouldn't say it's speculation. It's kind of grounded in reality, but it also hasn't been per se, you know, a plan that's documented that we could go to. But so say groups advocating for bison reintroduction, you know, they look at where would you put it? Well, Colorado and Eastern Plains would be an area, Montana. There's different activist group that have bought land out there to try to have preserves. So there's this desire of creating a national park somewhere. And that would be the advocacy piece of that. And then you kind of start to intertwine different, you know, cultural kind of ties to the land or various things, whether it be indigenous or other kind of strains there. And it all of a sudden gets super convoluted, right? It's, hey, this isn't just like vacant land out there, you know, like.
And I get it, right?
Yeah.
Like I think it's the American Serengeti Project or something like that, where they're like buying parcels of land. They're trying to connect the parks and these private parcels. There's interstate commerce issues here. There's federally protected species issues here. So you're already like opening all these different cans. And then everyone's got an opinion, whether it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do.
And the I would say the big viewpoint and the differentiation that we're starting to see related to kind of that Serengeti project, which is really based off of, you know, a Dan Flores book. He's kind of been the big proponent of that, which, you know, from a conceptual perspective, like I get his viewpoint of the West used to be this ecosystem where grizzlies and elk and all these animals roamed. It's just not that anymore. And I don't think you can ever restore it back to that because there's just too much of a human footprint. But groups have kind of activated on this ideal state of returning the state of nature to this, this kind of American Serengeti, which is probably in retrospect, you're probably looking at a decade of maybe 300-500 years ago, you know, before there was really, you know, substantial human impact on the land, even before you'd have very minimal indigenous populations there. Which is a huge, like, it's probably thousands of years, to be honest.
That's the conversation everywhere, whether it's wolves or lions or whatever. It's like, what is the right time in history to restore to? Yes. And why is that the right
time?
Can
you really do it?
Yeah.
The biggest separation between it is, it's, I think a lot of people latch onto it and say, oh, they want to create national parks. But the reality is that they're more on the mindset of preservation, meaning you can't access the land. You're not mm-hmm. going to be able to go out there. It's just an untouched, self-managed kind of plot of land that really has proven not to work out really well, you know, more mm-hmm. susceptible to wildfires, you know, spikes in population of animals on it based on, you know, good years, bad years, disease, et cetera, which management has smoothed that out. And the biggest concern with it is if these things were start to get traction and you started to go down this idea of moving huge portions of land into kind of more preserves, the more that you disconnect people from the landscape, you get a couple generations out. Kids maybe haven't been on the landscape, haven't seen, you know, the natural state. So they don't really have within them kind of this view of conservation and I want to help preserve it. And I get where my money goes for a fishing license or hunting license. You just don't have that. So it's kind of out of state, out of mind. So 20, 30 years down the road, those things are going to run into issues because people are going to say, well, why would I want my tax dollars going there? I don't touch it. I don't see it. I don't know it. I don't want it.
What value does it provide? And that's what happens.
Where national parks have been a little bit different. There's some stuff there that's kind of dicey. That's, you know, it's a good model for an area. The problem with it, like Yellowstone, good, successful model. You can't say anything bad about it. The problem with Yellowstone is when you get out of the park, the surrounding landscape, like, hey, this park's self-funded, but this other ecosystem outside of it, you run into conservation issues. That's where groups like us come involved and other, you know, you kind of keep those, you know, you continually try to keep the public aware. And as there's conservation issues kind of surrounding those national parks, you have a state agencies, you have different things with fishing and hunting license dollars to kind of help protect that for conservation that can only really, you know, operate in one designated area.
Well, I think that what that leads into or lends itself to is really starting to see the true colors of the organizations that advocated for these things in the first place. Because what you start to have in like the greater Yellowstone area is the same argument that we're starting to have here in Colorado. Wolves have been and are hitting the ground. And I think it woke a lot of people up to that ballot initiatives are a real impactful thing that can change what's happening on the landscape. And the thing is that the wolves aren't being released here in Boulder or Estes Park or Rocky Mountain National Park. They're being released, Grand Junction and the Western Slope and everywhere that the people who didn't want them there. And so I think people today spend a little too much time harping on, oh, the wolves. It's like, they're here. We need to continually advocate to get a management objective identified so that we don't run into Montana's problem or Idaho's problem, this moving target, these moving field goal posts. But at the same time, I do start to see that when these recovery objectives start to get met, then new lawsuits come up and then new new objective measures start to get proposed so that a hunting quota can't be implemented. And I think a fear of many is we're introducing a variable into the system without a regulation on the end of it, right? It's this like open-ended question mark what's being introduced into our society and our wildlife, and people are celebrating it. And I get the idea of like wolves on the landscape. There's a picture book version of that which feels good and looks good, but the realities of like the species and the subspecies, where do they introduce? Where do they get it from? When can we manage them? And what impact is that going to have on the recovery objectives of all the animals that already exist? Like, I think one thing that would shock people is that district wildlife managers have to do a management plan for every big game species in their unit that's required. There's 10 big game species in Colorado. These management plans are 10 years. Every 10 year, we're reevaluating what should be happening. So when we introduce like a new predator, we're undoing a lot of biological and scientific research and now have to factor in this new thing. And if we can't use hunters as a tool, which they are in the North American model, then there's this just giant question mark in the document. So it makes me nervous. But at the same time, I think what we need to do is become unified in talking about the value of what we do, because the big thing that I think is just the irony here is these groups, these anti-hunting groups or whatever their motives are, they're trying to dismantle a system that provides them what they want. wildlife, wild places, wild spaces, and both game and non-game species getting managed. And so when you start to dismantle that system and don't propose a solution to replace it, you're going to end up in a concrete jungle in 20 years.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't know what needs to be done from a boots on the ground standpoint with like wolves in the next 1 to 3 years. I don't know if anything can be done in terms of pushing people towards an objective, a recovery objective or a management objective or anything like that. Or is it even worth us talking about today?
So when wolves hit the ground, when we were going through the process, because we were involved last year and there was a bill by Senator Swill, Senator Roberts, Representative Lukens, and the deal was around preventing reintroduction until there was a clean 10J rule from U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And the importance of that 10J rule, because it would classify wolves as an experimental population that could be managed. And it's the managed piece. So jurisdiction would move away from U.S. Fish and Wildlife. It would be state managed and lethal control would be in the conversation. And that's where the whole controversy was, the lethal control aspect. If you can't use other means necessary. And that's where a lot of the activists stood up. Now it passed bipartisan across both chambers, ultimately vetoed at the governor's desk. And it was viewed as after the session was over, well, we'll get our 10J. But what he didn't say was when it was requested, he obviously, you know, can kind of controls the strings there. They never requested in the 10J for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife for lethal control in that aspect of it to a degree. So there is some form that the state can get involved in it, and they have to take up the case if lethal management needs to get involved in a particular case. But there's a pretty long, lengthy bureaucratic process with that if they can.
Yeah.
Or if they have the flexibility at the agency to do that without intervention from the administration. So I don't think it's so convoluted. Most people really didn't understand the wolf issue. And most of the media outlets, it's so complicated. Anybody who is on, so whether it's Colorado Public Radio, local press, no one really had a background in wildlife management or conservation management to really articulate like what's happening and what's the impacts if you know certain regulations are put in place with the wolf management and how problematic it could be across the board, right? So you have a pack that dens in a particular area. Remember, it's they're protected by the Endangered Species Act. Mm-hmm. And there could be a level degree of hazing that someone could file a lawsuit. So if it dens in somewhere on Vail Resort, someone could file a lawsuit to say, hey, you're hazing this population that's endangered. You need to
shut down Blue Sky Basin. Yeah.
Yes, you could, which wasn't articulated, you know? So you start to go through this process. How much do they eat? On average, a wolf, you know, eats maybe 15 pounds, 20 pounds of meat a day. You know, that's what it takes to sustain. Their territory, they move around 300 miles, you know, it's not all of a sudden when you start to convey those things, the size, all of a sudden people start to get really comfortable and we haven't even really started talking about the economic piece. So the biggest concern I see with the wolf issue, is I think all of us were in the same boat once we saw this is once these things are released, all of a sudden, the public's going to have a negative reaction, and it's going to build once they realize the cost. Once they all of a sudden you start to have conflict incidents, all of a sudden you're going to have issues that are going to start to escalate with the public where it's a, well, you're impacting me now. And that's what was not in the conversation. So the biggest myth that I've come across with wolves is the degree, and I've heard it repeatedly addressed in the media. Well, you know, a conflict with a human is an incredibly rare event, you know, and that literature is often put out by animal activist organizations that have pushed this. Mm-hmm. When I was reading some literature here the last couple months on it, and it's pretty interesting when you start to look and they start to document the wolf encounters that actually have happened and what where it occurs when you get into rural areas, Alaska, Canada, you have where the majority do happen in the US. You have a little bit in Minnesota. And then the bigger one is internationally. So the largest wolf population is actually in the country of Russia. They're about 45,000 wolves.
It's insane.
And you start to see like, hey, and they have deaths, right? And you see it in India and you see it in Iran as well. And it typically follows younger kids after 5 to 9 p.m., women. And then in the Alaska, Canada thing, people with dogs, you know, out walking dogs, out running, and all of a sudden you run into one or two wolves and a conflict occurs. Now, a little bit rarer in the US for someone to get killed. And I think there's a couple of reasons with it, but the attacks do occur. And what I'm hearing and through the literature that I was reading is the biggest concern for Colorado is where a lot of the attacks have occurred in Alaska and Canada is largely correlated to the degree of habituation that a particular pack has. So for example, if they get into an area, so some of the signs are they get into garbage dumps. Now they start feeding in that area. They start moving in on domestic animals. They start to have more and more conflicts with hikers. That starts to build to an escalating situation where it's not going to end well. So there's either going to be an issue with the wolf or it's going to be an issue with an individual and someone's going to get hurt. That is what has come out of a lot of the literature as to this could be a really big issue. What we see as they're reintroducing wolves in Idaho, Washington, you have stuff in Montana. So that's the biggest concern there. But yeah, I do think, it's going to be a big problem. The big thing that you heard and the reaction was when they dropped him in Grand Lake, all of a sudden was like, whoa, West Slope, not here.
Yeah.
People are here. That's going to be a problem. And then I think the other big issue is going to be the economic cost. So the ballot initiative initially said, I think it was like $900,000. To get over 3 years to get wolves kind of reintroduced and pushed out there. You're looking at like $1 million a year, like is what I think was spent. Mm-hmm. Your post reintroduction and like DNR has, they don't have it broken out specifically. It's really hard to get what they think that the go forward cost will be. But I would bet just off, you know, you start to look at the amount of staff to monitor, to collar, to continually research, you know, conflicts. As you scale it, I mean, it's easily, you know, $9 to $15 million, you know, annually. And it's like, where are you going to get that? You know, because, and that's all sitting on the general fund, right? It's, you couldn't, we moved it off the wildlife cash fund a couple years ago to say, hey, this is, that money's
which
all
I think
tied
is
up.
Huge. I think in order to make sure that this does actually impact the public who voted for it, it's a good thing that it's going to hit their checkbooks. But by bringing wolves here, we basically tithed the state to this obligation that is an endangered species obligation, which has those further implications as you were just expelling out. But I think what you're getting at here is that there's this charismatic piece and then there's a reality piece. And it's really easy to sell the charismatic story about these things. And it's leading me to the conversation around lions now, which is this banning on this proposed ballot initiative to ban mountain lion, bobcat, and lynx hunting, where we don't even hunt lynx here. and the thing that's frustrating about that is, I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but you never know who's going to listen to this. It's the most regulated hunt in the state. You got to take a special test to do it. There's quotas and there's daily call-in and check-ins from these outfitters that are running these numbers and making sure it's like, if we're going over quota, we're going over quota by like five lions, not by 500. We're taking less than 10% of the population a year. And it just seems like, I don't know if we would manage lions. We would probably manage nuisance lions, but the example I always bring up is California. They went from hunting 200 lions a year to paying a professional hunter to cull those same 200 lions a year, now at a taxpayer detriment. it just seems silly to me. And the messaging around it is frustrating. And I think the thing that, and please keep me true here, it feels like it's inevitable that'll end up on the ballot, right? Like they need 120 something thousand signatures, and it's hard to stop that momentum. With that being, well, is there, let me pause there. Is there a chance that the influence gets out early enough where people see these things? And I live in Boulder. I go down to the campus. Someone's going around to the flyer. How many people aren't signing that?
Now, I think you'll get, I think it will end up on a ballot initiative. It may not. I mean, there might be some education. I mean, the reality is how ballot initiatives work. You hire people. You hire people to get the signatures. So it's just business. How much money is it going to cost?
Yeah.
And that's what they plan for this stuff. So it's not really anything from that perspective that I'm like super, it's going to happen. The biggest concern with it is when I'm thinking through it, is going to be mostly around education of the average voter.
Yes.
To say yay or nay on the actual initiative. And that's where a lot of the work will come in on it. But the reality is most of these activist organizations, they're nonprofits. They set up, there's a sizable amount of money. I mean, people do this for a living. That's mm-hmm. That's what their job is, you know? So they're always going to have a, it's not like that they're doing things to make conservation better, or they have a better plan, or this is what's going to benefit society. It's emotion, and it's a, hey, if you're in New York or Chicago or wherever you're at, give us $5, you can change the world.
Yep.
And someone sits there and says, hey, yeah, I want to change the world, mm-hmm. you know? But you don't really look at, what is it going, you know? Like, or, of that five, you know, of a buck, probably 20 cents of it, it's going to go to something. Because
right.
by the time you take out the salaries and the paychecks and the lawyer, like, it's just, it's a different kind of view of politics. And that's, we've seen it come more and more. And like I said, like, we've seen, God, when we first got involved, there was the senator out of Boulder who tried to ban it. And mm-hmm. we all ended up at the Capitol, right? And I think we were there. We're all there, right? We're all getting involved. And you've seen it escalate just from that stance, right? It was unilaterally, like, the bill died in committee. And they tried it multiple times through the, you know, CPW commission. It died there unilaterally. Because once you start to have fact-based conversations, like, if you have 5,000-6,000 lions in the state of Colorado, okay, you don't manage them. What happens? If a lion on average takes, what, 20 pounds of meat a day to live, and you're killing them basically about a deer or elk a week.
Times 5,000.
Yeah. Like, it's 207,000 animals that are gone. Like, and you start to exponentially increase the population, like, it doesn't work.
You know?
And that's where I think the general public kind of looks, and it's like, that's not good. And, well, you know,
I think what you're spelling out nicely here, that it is, as much as it feels like the hunting community versus the anti-hunting community, it's not really that. It's the mm-hmm. hunting community and the anti-hunting community trying to win over the middle. And so it's this, you have this, let's call it a propaganda machine on the anti-hunting side, just saying these charismatic emotional stories. And then you have these like logical old white men, which isn't the best way to win an argument. You can ask anybody's girlfriend or wife, oh, the logic is really what won me over there. But the idea being is that, like, I want people to recognize that it's not convincing the person who's already going to vote no today. It's the convincing that undecided voter. And with that convincing, it's not about, look how dumb these people are and look how smart these people are. It's about the North American model. It's about this technique called nonviolent communication. It's about educating about something you're passionate about without offending the person's lack of knowledge, ignorance, or misguided information about what they do care about. And so I think that's one thing that really makes my skin crawl a little bit, is like, you see a controversial post on Instagram or YouTube or whatever, and then a bunch of like quote unquote hunters being like saying a bunch of negative stuff in there. You libtards, you anti this, you idiots. And it's just like, that makes me look bad. And I don't want you to make me look bad. That makes us look bad. It doesn't move the needle. Cause again, you're not convincing the anti who's making the post. You're convincing the people reading it. So if the people reading it are perceiving you as an asshole or a jerk, they might vote against you because they're just indifferent to this issue. So let me just join the guy who's not being a jerk in the conversation. And I think that's where we have to be really measured this year and like really lean on the efforts of CRWM and Save the Hunt Colorado, because, and I'll let you speak to this a little better, like CBA is a 501c3. We are a nonprofit, but there's a certain percentage of our funds that can get designated for lobbying. And if you're not a CBA member, please join. $40 a year. If you buy in some broadheads, buy a membership. But if you are a CBA member, think about giving to Save the Hunt Colorado, because they are a group that is designed as a nonprofit lobbying organization that has the ability to put more effort into this than we are actually like legally allowed to. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So a couple things. Save the Hunt Colorado, Dan Gates org, CRWM. They are set up 100% to lobby. So they're a 501c4, right? So that aspect, it allows them to kind of do advocate for policies. It's not taxable, your donation, right? And that's a big distinction between other nonprofits is the tax exempt status. So most of these other organizations, conservation organizations, all that money is going to, you know, efforts on the ground, conservation, you know, fence pulling studies, et cetera. So it's all good work. Mm-hmm. They were just never set up to go lobby because they never really had to. Mm-hmm. They're set up to more make a difference on from conservation perspective. So Dan got involved in it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, right? And that's where the genius was setting this thing up. To say, you know, at one point, like as we continue to see continued attempts and whittling down, we need to have some form of a unilateral, you know, thing to set up and push back against this stuff. The donation there, I mean, early on, he had hired lawyers to get before the ballot initiative because he knew it was coming, like fundraising. So versus the Wolf one, they were set up way in advance to start attacking and chipping away at it and wherever you can. And that's the big aspect of donations, highly needed. And like I said, it's 100% going to the cause. You know, you can't be any more crystal on that. So highly, highly needed. When you look at conservation, I think if you look to your point, the average hunter, what I seen, at least when I got involved, most people want to go and they talk hunting stories and show up and like, hey, I want to be involved for conservation. Nobody wants to get involved in the political side. Mm-hmm. So you get very few who show up to say, oh yeah, I want to be 100% involved in politics. Most of them are like, I'm done with this. I don't want any involvement. And that's been the hardest issue around trying to evangelize our base and the hunting base in general, because it's like, I deal enough with this. This is my hobby. I'm not coming to my hobby to go lobby. And, you know,
or this is my escape from the world, right? This is my escape from politics. And now it's here in the backcountry with me.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, over time, I think that has softened. And I think people just saw with the Wolf piece, this is so just beyond like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And, from multiple levers of like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, this is just ridiculous. And then once you basically see like this cats group that came in with, you know, Carol Baskin from Tiger King, and now we're going to like stop, like, you don't even live here. And now you're going to sit there and just ban it for why? Like, there's no conversation. There's no logic. There's nothing on any of this. And that's been the biggest conversation piece with it that we've been kind of more, I think people have just gotten more frustrated, right? But I feel like there were a lot of big steps when I say this time is different, in that before all this had even really started to happen, when they made the first attempt with the mountain lion ban, there was the conversation of all the groups in Colorado to say, hunting groups, we got problems. Like, we got to unite, because if we don't do this, we're going to get picked apart. And that's where the formation of Colorado Conservation Project, that CWCP, came involved. Mm-hmm. So you had 28 hunting organizations. It's like, okay, we're going to start meeting weekly. You know, we're going to start talking through this. We're going to start getting engaged, and we're starting unified voice. And, you know, Dan's the chair of that, our vice chair of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, that was kind of the momentum piece. And then once, you know, we started to see success, you know, we've always had success at the commission, but once you started to see it at the legislature and we're winning stuff and we're more organized, you start to get the national groups kind of noticing a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. how it kind of gets involved, because they started to see the vacancy issues across the state with other, you know, other states. Mm-hmm. And so you, there's a lot of work that went into it. So when it really took off with the ballot initiative, and all of a sudden, you know, CRWM's pushing back on it and has lawyers, and, you know, all of a sudden that's where the national folks, like you get the Steve Ranellas that did the thing here in Denver. You've got Cameron Haynes in there. You've got Derek Wolf, like these huge influencers who are like, hey, this is going to happen to my state. Like, mm-hmm. this isn't just a, it happens in Colorado, and they're like, hey, this group's like, oh, cool, we're done. You know, it's, hey, Wyoming, it's New Mexico, Arizona, Utah. Like, let's just keep going, you know?
And well, that's one thing I appreciate. Yeah. Sorry, let me let you finish your thought there.
But yeah, so no, that's kind of it, you know? And that's why I think what's different this time is, I think people just had enough. And it's a, hey, why wouldn't you stand up to push back against these groups? Like, they don't, I'm trying to be crude, but like, there's just no value that when you look at what do you do from a societal perspective? Well, you mm-hmm. don't like it, so you ban it. Okay, so mm-hmm. there's no youth outreach, there's no conservation elements, there's no engagement and community engagement. It's, we don't like it, it should go away. Mm-hmm. Well, someone else will take care of it. We're not going to go tax raise. We're not going to go find funding. We're not going to go find for this other plan. We'll just, the government will pay for it.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like, cause you look at it with the Wolf thing, there was no plan to raise $20 million a year to fund it. It was, oh, well, it'll just go to the general fund, or the hunting license could pay for it.
Right. Like, it's not some altruistic donor. For the rest of my life, no. Tying a part of my state to this cause.
Well, and you had big money involved in it too.
To right? get it there over was, the across the finish line, and then well, they'll I mean, go put of, a, that effort into another initiative and leave the taxpayers with the bill.
There was a billionaire involved out of Montana who had done the same thing in Arizona or New Mexico with the New Mexican Wolf, because he owned land down there, and he's a big bison farmer up in Montana, and it's a... None of his money's really in it, you know. He's not yep. fundraising to say, "Oh, well, we'd pay for it in Colorado," or I got you know, connections.
I can even relate it to just business. Like, my title is a solutions engineer, and the idea is that I come up with solutions for businesses to see if my product is a technical fit for them. It's construction management mm-hmm. software, but the idea being is that, like, in business, if someone comes to you and tells you a problem, they're a pain in the ass. If someone comes to you and tells you a problem and presents a solution, they're the best employee you have. And so, like, it shifts completely when you go from being the squeaky wheel to the squeaky wheel that brought their own grease. And we have a ton of squeaky wheels here. And that's the thing, is like, it's really easy to raise the red flag and raise the awareness and make people emotional and compassionate to the cause, but they're not finishing their swing. They're not, maybe they are in their eyes, but the idea being is like, you're introducing a societal change without proposing the end of the story. You're just proposing the introduction. And it's frustrating, because it takes the reality of wolves hitting the ground for the people who voted for it to then regret their decision based on the lack of information that they had at the time. I think one thing that's beautiful is that we now have these voices, like you said, with Meat Eater, Rogan, Ranella, a lot of these people are speaking up about it. And I don't know if this is controversial or not. They better be, right? These people who are making their lives off of social media and off of social medializing hunting, these hunting personalities, these hunting influencers. Buddy, if you're going to extract my $30 so I could get your boning labeled veins or whatever, then you better use your audience and your platform to make sure that this cause matters to people. One thing that we have going for us is that Colorado is such a hunting friendly state that most of the people that don't live here have hunted here and realize how easy it is. And so in addition to them having a personal connection and sharing it with their audience, there's another part of this that I wanted to talk about, and maybe we could talk about getting involved with the commission as well, which is just the idea of trophy hunting, right? Because like we can speak all day long to them, and if you can't, please get educated on it. But the North American model, Randy Newberg did a 5-part series with who's the old white guy? Not Valerius Geist. Is it Valerius Geist?
Was it Shane Mahoney?
Shane Mahoney. And he did like a 5-part series on the North American model. All of us take road trips, download it, listen to it. It's useful. If not, ask ChatGPT, what are the tenets of the North American model? It will tell you, and it's pretty good. I've played with all this stuff. But the point being is arm yourself with the knowledge so that you can have these conversations. I'll make 2 points here, and then we can kind of continue. Go to catsaren'ttrophies.com and see what they're saying. See how they're positioning their arguments. Learn where they're lying. Learn where they're telling the truth so we can do what's called objection handling out in the field. When someone says, well, I read this, I heard this, I saw this. Don't call them stupid. Don't shout them down. Be armed with the information so that you can rebut these things in a calm manner. That being said, this whole thing, I think the reason why we're getting as much attention as we're getting is, yeah, people care about lions, but people care about the terminology trophy hunting being brought into anti-hunting legislation. How valid is that as a concern?
It's a concern. I think so. What I think they're essentially attempting to do is they're trying to make a legal argument and put it in statute to tie trophy hunting that they can then utilize in other
point to in the future. Yeah. My parents are lawyers, and it's real, yeah. Right? You can make like case law and you can make precedent. And I think that's what's scary is like, I was telling my fiance, I was like, if a girl hunts a white-tailed doe and you like turn the white tail into like a little necklace, that's her trophy. Yeah. So like trophy hunting is in the eye of the beholder, and the fact that they want to codify it is to me what's potentially scary across the entire nation.
Yes. It's super freaky. That's the biggest piece about it that has a lot of people concerned with it. Just because, I mean, high-powered lawyers, they're trying to use it, weaponize it across other, you know, municipalities, states, to try to just get legal footholds. And that's kind of what they do, just from a general perspective. That's what these groups have made a living on, is just kind of doing this, going from state to state, setting up shop, getting money, and then trying to see what they can throw against the wall to stick. Yeah. And that's the biggest aspect that I think finally it's gotten to the point where people are just tired. People are frustrated. People have seen this happen to their state. And now people are looking at it to say, no, we're good. If this is the avenue and this is the stand, we're going to push back on it. We're going to push back hard to kind of make sure that we're not having to do this again.
And I hope so.
And that's good. And I think that's what's really good about the Colorado situation, is that a lot of people, like you saw it on social media, it went from 0 to like 100.
Dude, almost so fast,
like in that the top level of people in this industry are involved and actively talking about it, you know, across the nation, and people are pissed about it. Like, it's, I don't think that they really thought through it, that there would be a visceral reaction and that we could mobilize as quickly, and that we were, you know, just, you know, you get pushed to a point. And that's the piece where I think it's really, it's getting momentum there. So there should be some good. Yeah.
I think the thing that's interesting is like, we as a community, as a hunting community, need to maintain the energy behind this. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to stay excited. It's hard to stay invigorated. It's hard to stay informed. So I think that's one key factor. And then the other thing that I heard, which honestly makes a lot of sense, is like, bleed them financially. So like, if they did not expect this level of pushback and they thought that their expenditure was going to get them further down the road than it has. If we keep doing that to them, at some point, this is going to be a bad investment. Even if it's philanthropic, they're not getting as much bang for their buck. And they're trying this avenue because the legislative avenue wasn't working over the past few years. And so they're trying this way. And this is just, it's all a math equation in terms of how much money can I spend and how much influence can I get from spending that money. And so what I wanted to tell people is just like, beyond being informed, beyond talking to your friends, family, relatives, neighbors, strangers, get actually involved, like at the commission level, you know, and like telling the commission that you don't want mountain lion hunting banned isn't going to change it from being on the ballot. However, giving them information about your feelings about hunting, about North American model, about what this means to you, your family, your community, that's going to, these are human beings at the end of the day, whether they're appointed by our governor, which they were, who we all assume his husband has anti-hunting desires. That being true or not, make your voice heard, because if every commissioner gets 10 calls from hunters and one call from anti-hunters, it does move the needle. It sways it on a subconscious level, if not a conscious level.
It does. And what I would say, so a couple things with that. You know, don't just write your commissioner or call or whatever you're going to do, write. Go to the meetings. Go listen to them. Go educate. So before you go write, start to look and actually hear the conversations that are going on. Inform yourself and kind of understand the landscape and make it part of a just a routine of, hey, the meeting's going to be here. Maybe I can't go in person. Maybe I'll go listen online. Start talking about that with your friends and neighbors. And the other one is, do you know who your legislator is? Mm-hmm. Go look up online at, you know, Colorado General Assembly. It says, who's my legislator? Put your address in. Go look at what they're involved in. Go look at what legislation they're at. And, you know, pick up the phone, write an email, you know.
Stop by their office. They have a local office in your town.
You know, you start to network and banter with these folks to say, hey, there's a sizable amount of hunting, you know, that brings to the economy. What are you doing to help preserve this? What do you think on this issue? You know, get more involved in your local government, because that's essentially of how we're going to win this thing. It's really grassroots based of, you got to show up and you got to be willing to sit there to say, hey, I don't agree with this, you know, and be part of the dialogue and process. The issue and kind of how we got to this point is, It's the same folks who show up to the commission meetings, and it's the same folks who show up to the legislature, you know, and it's just not sustainable, right? Now it's pretty similar on their side too, but at some point, you know, the momentum is, you got to bring more people and you got to have more people that show up to do this. And that's what we need to do.
I like that messaging too, because like, it's so, easy to get sucked in to national politics right now, this year, Trump, Biden, who's smart, who's stupid, who's whatever. You won't affect change there. Go vote for who you're going to go full for at the federal level. Put all of your energy into local, because that's where you'll affect change. Your congressman, your senator, your Colorado congressman and senator will call you back. We'll pick up the phone. We'll actually sit down and have a meeting with you. Like, these people are accessible. And I think that if we make it a part, like you said, make it a part of your routine. And for me, I've made it, and this is like, I'm trying to make it a low bar so I can go over it. But I was like, I want to make contact with every commissioner at some point over the next 10 months, email, be at a meeting, ask a question, what have you. Reach out to my legislator, senator and legislator about this stuff. And then the one last thing is, like, if you want to actually have your voice heard on record in these meetings, look up the meetings, set a reminder in your phone, and set a reminder for 10 days before you can submit to be a speaker at those meetings. And then you can just stand up and ask your question.
Yeah. I mean, and I would say, like you said, the commission, your state representatives and senators, and then I would say your federal representatives and senators, you know, don't be shy. Like, who represents you and what are they doing? Are you aligned with their policies and vice versa? Make sure you drop a note, because if they're not hearing from you, and most people don't email that level, You know, it's there's a degree of accountability there that you can hold, and you can press people that, you know, even may they may share your political affiliation. They may not be voting the way you think they should be voting on a conservation issue. And that's part of the dialogue, is to hold those people accountable. And then the last piece I would say is get involved with the local hunting group, you know, whether it's CBA, whether it's RMEF, this, because when you're going to go take a stance and you're going to communicate with folks, it's helpful to have the feedback from those groups, because there may be an overarching element of like, well, it's not really that bad, or we're supporting it. You may be against it, but did you know there's this element within it? And that's how the game works, because that's the biggest, that's the hardest issue when you start to get to these pieces of conservation and interrelation with agencies, is everybody has a stance. You hear something, oh, that's crazy. And then you go and actually look at the press briefing that comes out and the policy from BLM, and you read it and you're like, I have no idea what the hell they're talking about. Like, like, how did that person get that? Because this is like 15 pages. This is super complicated. And that's where it dies, right? People look at it and it's like, well, I'm not commenting. I sound like an idiot. Like, I don't know what they're talking about. But going back to someone in one of these hunting groups or these conservation groups to say, well, what does this mean? How does it impact me? There's probably bullet points and comments to say, well, this is what's going to happen. Well, I don't like that. Okay, I can write a letter based off of that. Drop a quick note, put some feedback into it. And that's where a lot of these grassroots organizations, Muley Fanatics, Mule Deer Foundation, US, SCI, RMEF, National Wildlife Federations, you know, CRWM, like, they can provide that guidance to say, well, here's the policy issues. You know, this is what's happening. This is why it's concerning.
And it's a double-edged effort, because you are eyes for that organization, but also you, and be people listening, be careful with this. You're not representing the organization, but you can let these people know that you are part of that organization. Hi, my name is Jay Kunkin. I'm a member of the CBA. I'm a member of RMEF. And what that says to them is that you're part of a community that cares about this, not an individual who cares about this.
Yes. Hey, I'm part of this community. Hey, I live in this county. Hey, you're my representative.
I vote.
That all of a sudden, it's like, whoa, like, we got a
problem. This got real.
Like, what? Like, what do you mean? And, you know, all of a sudden you get a handful of people that show up. And that's been the biggest element when we've killed these bills. It's, holy crap, 300 people show up pissed off and civil and engaging in discourse. And all of a sudden people are like, well, I don't want that. Like, news cameras show up, like, we need to get off of this. Let's get out of here. This doesn't make sense.
Not good press.
Then all of a sudden everybody's about conservation and hunting and every, you know, like, oh, you guys are stewards of the land and we didn't mean it to you. So yeah, it's like I said, it's flexing a different muscle, and there's some muscle memory there, but it's once you start to get in that rhythm and you learn the process, you learn self-advocating for what you believe in, and you start to get in, you know, both, you know, a government agency process or, you know, legislative process and be part of that discord, like it makes a big difference. It makes a huge difference. And the problem with our system today, so whether you're pro hunting or anti hunting or vice versa, if you look at the anti hunting side, it's not like there's 400 people there. You have like a small group of people who are noisy that probably represent maybe 1-2% of the national politics, or, you know, the conversation, you know, but yet, you know, it makes it sound like, oh, everybody's, you know, anti-hunting. And when you realize they're not, you know, vast majority of people, like, it's over, it's in the 60% range, support hunting because they get it. But it's when these 2% get vocal, twist an issue, all of a sudden people are like, well, I'm not really in favor of that, but I don't really know. So sure, I'll just take your word for granted, you know?
Right.
That's where the conversation goes sideways. And then all of a sudden, now, can you win elections that way? Yes. Can you win policy that way? Yes. Does it backfire? I think it does. Yep. Because when the policy goes south, and then all of a sudden people are like, well, you told me. Like, all of a sudden you start to lose credibility, you know?
And absolutely.
That's where. But if you're not building anything and you're just coming in and out of elections to do things, you don't really care about that. that's why it's different from our groups, because, well, you're here and you've been on the landscape for 50-100 years, you know, like you're not going anywhere. So you're not lying to people or putting misstatements out there, or twisting the truth to put policy. Like it's, you're here and we're at the table in the start of time to create policy, you know?
Absolutely. But I also think that it can feel a little bit like we're in an echo chamber because we've decided on this as a lifestyle. So it's a lot of what we do, think about, consume, live. Yeah. And the reality is, like, hunters are the minority of the population. And yeah. us as hunters are probably the hunter in our family. Maybe you come from a family of hunters. I wish I did. My kids yeah. will hunt. We'll see. But the point being is, like, I am the uncle that hunts at the gatherings and my family gatherings. And so have these conversations. Have these conversations with your friends. Have them at Indoor League. Have them at Total Archery Challenge. Have them at your family. Family dinners. It's better than talking about Trump and Biden. Talk about mountain lions. It's going to be yeah. an easier conversation. Yeah. But the idea Very being true. Is like, learn how to become a spokesman. And if you yeah. need some guidance there, like Wes said, reach out to your local organization. Reach out to Wes. Reach out to me. Reach out to Lane Walter, our CPW liaison. Like, we are yeah. happy to engage with you, to give you tools to how you could speak to your friends, your enemies, whomever you want to, your colleagues. I put it in my LinkedIn profile recently. Like, I just put it, you know, hunter, builder, you know, construction, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's not for anything. It is a bit of virtue signaling, but the idea being is that it's like rare in business that people talk about hunting, yeah. maybe not so much in construction or oil or gas or whatever, but like every other part of the world. And so just that idea of like, normalize this to people, show that it is a thing that isn't cruel. It's not Elmer Fudd. It's not thought about. Lion mountains get consumed for meat. Just yeah. all of these pieces of the puzzle that seem so glaringly obvious to us. Go back to kindergarten, be nice to people, and educate and be an advocate for not only the policy, but for the community. Wow, the hunting community are really stand-up people. They participate, they volunteer, they help out. They're, you know, be an upstanding citizen and not sure, do it, fake it till you make it. If you don't want to be an upstanding citizen, pretend to be one. That's great. But the reality is, like, be the change you want to see in the world. And it's okay. I'm a yoga teacher. I sell software. I also hunt. Like, I'm this anomaly of people, but it's okay. I'm Jake Kunkin and I could go be in the world. So, like, I encourage folks to take the initiative, have an uncomfortable conversation, but don't make it uncomfortable. Be the person that makes it easy. No, is there any... True. Any other things that you wanted to cover or that I didn't bring up that we should be aware of, something coming down the pike, things we could participate in, just stuff to be abreast to?
No, I think that's the big one for now. You know, that's the biggest aspect that not to convolute or get people off on a different topic, you know, that's the biggest thing that we need to really look at going forward. So no, yeah. I mean, it's been a while since we did one. So yeah, you and I are just going to keep up the routine and
yeah, we should make this regular, like monthly, if not more frequently.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So we'll make sure you get that going.
Awesome, man. Is there anything hunting wise, we are a hunting podcast, that you're looking forward to in 2024?
I think the biggest thing is my kids, both my kids, my youngest will be of age this year to kind of get out to hunt.
What age is that, Colorado? 12,
14, 12. 12. Yeah. So it's kind of his first time out. So
do you have a game plan in terms of like, how can I make this approachable, but hard enough where he gets the experience, but wants to come back?
We're finding one. We're defining that. That's,
I love it.
You know,
is it going to do you know what species?
I think we might do rifle deer or rifle antelope. So here's the plan. The plan is, can I get him at a state with a bow that he can pull the poundage because he is 12 and he's a little lighter? Can I get both of them to get into the 50s in the next, you know, handful of months? And mm-hmm. we're on track for that. And then the goal is, so we might go out for one species, you know, maybe deer, something like that, back Minnesota, Wisconsin area, and then maybe try to do a little bit here and then go out for maybe some antelope rifle or do something that they can at least have you know, an attempt at success. You know, try a little bit of bow hunting, try a little bit of, you know, this, but let's kind of get that under the, you know, get that going before we get crazy.
I love it. Yeah. And I think that you're, I don't have kids yet, but the approach is very mindful, right? Like, how do we make it where it's sticky, that you can actually get involved and have a real experience? Like, you know, a tree stand deer hunt is an easy way to have an encounter.
yes.
And then also the discipline side of it. I heard Steve Rinella talking about his oldest wanting to bow hunt. And he said, if you shoot your bow every day this week, you take your bow. And he didn't shoot it every day. And he canceled the hunt on him. He's like, you got to take bow hunting seriously. You could go with a rifle. I've seen you shoot a rifle all day. But that's really cool. I'm equally excited for a similar thing in the complete opposite direction. My father-in-law-to-be, is an avid hunter, lives in Montana, has a bird dog.
Oh, nice.
Just getting into archery. So we got him a nice prime bow last year, and he wants to come to Colorado for an elk hunt. So I'm excited about that. He's turning 70 this year. So I said, let's go to Montana Big Sky TAC. So in case you have a heart attack on the mountain, there's an ambulance nearby. And then a month later, I'll take you to the backcountry of Colorado. So I'm super psyched about that bonding experience, and also just the idea of like showing somebody what I've been able to experience and learn. Yeah. I have another buddy who's also interested in that. So I have a few potential take people out on hunts this year that I'm pumped about.
Nice.
And then I think up to see how the draw goes. The unit that I like to rifle hunt for cow elk was one that was impacted by winter kill, so it's harder to get a tag. So I'm debating using that rifle one season just to like guide friends, have them apply, and then get a either sex and a cow archery elk tag. And that way I've got like 21 days allocated for archery elk next year. I already put in my nice. PTO. And so I'm like, I really, really want to get it done. I don't know if you know CJ Sefcovic. I interviewed him on this pod. He did an article for CBA. It's a little older than me, but he's similar timeline, moved out to Colorado like 4 or 5 years ago. For a few years in a row, was getting a bull and a cow with his bow. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a cool goal. So
that is neat. Yeah.
Part of my goal is that, and the other part of my goal is guiding. So we'll see if my selfish instincts take over, if an opportunity presents itself or not. But I'm so super psyched for this year. I've never felt more excited for an upcoming season. So
no, that's really way cool, man.
We'll see how it all goes, man. I'm pumped. Oh. I'm feeling good, and just trying to get into. I was telling my girlfriend, I was like, if I could get into elk shape by May 1st, then treat all of spring and summer as honing versus getting ready. we'll see. Lofty goal, but if I could get my sight tape on and my mountain legs under me, I'll feel all right.
No, absolutely, man. Like I said, I'm excited for it. I mean, like, I think it's going to be a fun year, and it's going to come quicker. It's going to come sooner than later.
It's going to be here. I mean, we're already like mid-February. Time is flying. We're all going to be so focused on like the mountain lion and other stuff that like got to remember that we're also hunters and get out there and be ready for it.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, dude, now I'm engaged. We're talking about family planning and all this other stuff. I was like, oh, this might be the last year of true freedom. And not that I'm not excited for it. It's just a different relationship to it.
It's good. Yeah. Like I said, it's really cool stuff. It just, man, it takes, once you have kids, man, it's hard. It's really hard.
Priority shift.
It is the priority shift. It's not too bad when you have, when it's just kind of you and your wife, it's pretty good. Like it's you realize like early marriage, like things change and you're like, ah, you know, well, you know, and then I don't have as much time and you know, you're doing stuff together and then you have kids and you're like, oh my Lord, I just squandered so much free time. Like,
shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Yeah. Shoulda, woulda, coulda.
I hear you there, man. Wes, this has been awesome. I appreciate you carving out some time.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. We have to do this again soon.
Yeah, we'll put one on the books. We'll do it in like a month or so.
Okay. Let's do it, man. Cool. I appreciate it. Thanks, Jake.